So pleased to say I'm joined in the studio by Joe Sample. Welcome again to London. You first came here in, what, 74, did you?
Yes, it was 74. Actually, I went to Paris, a wild thing. The Beach Boys, who were big fans of the Jazz Crusaders, invited me to go to Paris for a Christmas season UNICEF show. And so I went there, and we were in the opera house there, and I remember doing four songs with the Beach Boys. They left. They had given me a two-week paid vacation. I was roaming around Paris, and I suddenly found myself being in fights with Frenchmen, and I didn't know why. Then I would go to a market. I just said, man, what is going on? I went to a bar eventually one night, and the legendary blues man, Memphis Slim, was there, and he was at the bar, and we started speaking, and he knew of the Crusaders, all the Jazz Crusaders, and I asked him, man, what's going on? And he looked at me and he said, son, don't you know you are the wrong color? I said, what do you mean I'm the wrong color? And he said, don't you realize you look like an Algerian?
No.
So I looked like, you know, they had that war with the Algerians and the French. Eventually, de Gaulle was called back to serve. And a year later, de Gaulle said, I have come up with a solution. My French people, pack your stuff up and come on back home to France. So I was walking around Paris in 65 looking like an Arab terrorist, an Algerian. And people were cursing me out, and I was putting my fists up. Come on, you. It was baba, baba, baba. The police were coming up to me, and when I would pull out my American passport, they would back off and say, pardon, monsieur, pardon. So then I finally figured out, I'm going to take my own money. I'm getting out of here. I'm going over to London. Instead of being cursed out in the streets of Paris, everyone would see me on a street corner in London, and everybody was coming, sir, can I help you? Are you lost? So it was night and day.
Oh, I was glad you got good memories of London from that early on. So let's take you really early on. I mean, you were a student of Curtis Mayo, weren't you, when you first started? How did that happen?
Well, he was in Houston. He was a professor at Texas Southern University, which was an all-black university. And at that particular time, one of the right-wing madmen, Senator Joe McCarthy, was attacking everyone and everybody, movie producers, movie fans, workers. Mm-hmm. And any black man who had been involved in civil rights, they were accused of being communists. So Dr. Mayo basically was kicked out of Texas, and he then went to Florida, and he became a professor there at Florida A&M, which was another black university. So. The Republican right-wing madness got my first best piano teacher. They kicked him out of Texas.
Quite a piano teacher. But you were 3 years old, weren't you, when you started playing the piano? Was that from your mum and dad?
My oldest brother, who was 15 years older than I was always sitting at the piano. He idolized Teddy Wilson. He then joined the United States Navy in the Second World War. So he was in an all black naval band in World War II, and occasionally that band would come through Southeast Texas. And my mother would cook a meal for them, which was a Creole cuisine, and I would look up one evening, and there were all of these black men sitting in the living room with clarinets, trombones, cornets, with sailor suits on. So I went to the Creole public school at 5 years old in 1944, and Father Kyle asked me, son, what would you like to do in life? I told him, well, I want a cornet and a sail suit. So that was the beginning. And at that time, it was boogie-woogie. There was boogie-woogie everywhere. You know, we were segregated. Life was extremely boring, and you had to always do something to keep yourself entertained. So, and most families had an upright piano, a spinet in the living room, and the kids would get together, and we would hold these boogie-woogie wars, you know. So that's how it all began. At 6 years old, I told my mother I want to start taking piano lessons. And about 2 years later, I guess, in 47 or whatever, I began to recognize that I was learning all of these German names. I thought that was the wildest thing. We had been at war with these guys, and what am I doing now? I'm learning all of their music, Beethoven, Bach, Mozart. It went on and on. So it was, everything was a mystery to me, you know. But I loved the one. And the one thing that amazed me with a Beethoven composition, which was Moonlight Sonata, I sat there and I was still playing it, and of course I had a young pianist version, and I used to think every time I play this thing I get chills going down my back, and I was thinking, wow, this thing is about 200 years old. He must have had chills down his back. That was when I recognized the power of music, something that can live, you know, that human emotion and that something of spiritual value that he had written in Moonlight Sonata, 200 years later, I was getting it.
Choose us a first tune, if you would, Jen.
All God's Children. I remember writing it. I had no particular reason to write it. Just a lot of times, just thing. I had a way of sitting down, and I would practice constantly. And that is to, I'll always want to make sure that when I touch the piano, I am touching it exactly the way I should be touching it. So every day I wake up, I have to untie my fingers, you know, like you see the football players, the soccer
stretching
players.
Yeah.
They stretch. Mm. They stretch. So I do the same thing every day. And all of a sudden, I hear melodies, and I don't really think of melodies. I hear them. To me, they are gifts. They just come from the ozone, and I will just start feeling good, and I act like I have been playing this song a long time, or I know this piece of music I'm playing. I don't know what it is, but I know it, and I just fumble. Now, what was that next section? I recorded, and weeks later, or months later, I will go back and listen to them, and I will say, man, this is really good. I will then transfer that onto another tape and keep it. So in other words, I collect emotions usually. But one of my most favorite things is to just sit there and noodle all day long. And at the end of the night, I am rewarded with gifts. And All God's Children was one of those pieces. I hear it. And suddenly a title will surface. Thank you.
That was All God's Children, the choice of my special guest, Joe Sample. You've talked about how you actually write things and so on. Let me bring you forward to sort of 1971. You described then as a sort of part of the progressive jazz scene. What did, I mean, I'm sure you don't like labels, but what was progressive jazz?
There have always been labels of everything. And you know, people would tell me that you are a progressive jazz musician. I didn't know what the hell that was. But people would tell me that's what I was doing. There were always categories. Around 68, I made a decision that I was not going to continue to build a life in the jazz clubs of the United States, because I felt as if it was a waste of my life, because the pianos were horrible. All the other musicians had their horns. They could nurse them, take care of them, you know, and they could get on a bandstand and play. And what did I do? I walked into every jazz bar across America, and I would witness every dog du jour. So I told the Crusaders, I can't do this anymore. And we were the jazz Crusaders then. And I just said, I can't do it. There is something better in my life. And I realized that the worst life that any musician could have is the life of the piano player.
But you, was that something to do with your choice about using an electric piano? Because there can't have been many around at the time.
Well, I knew. I had seen in the 50s... that Ray Charles was on the Steve Allen Show, and for the first time I heard a Wurlitzer piano. I think it was in the early 60s, maybe 61, he had a very prominent hit called What I Say, Dong, Ding, Dong, Ding, Dong, Ding, Dong. So, you know, I bought a Wurlitzer. It wasn't... You could play soulful and bluesy and gospel things on it. I never really thought of the Wurlitzer as a jazz piano, although I have recorded on it, occasionally. There was also the Fender Rhodes. I did not like playing it because I would destroy it. So one day, Mr. Rhodes asked me would I come out to the factory at Fullerton, California, out near Disneyland. I went out there, and he said that he understood that me and Joe Zawinul did not like the Fender Rhodes because we would always destroy it. So he said, I have made it stronger, and he gave me one, and I began playing it. I fell in love with it, and the first thing I noticed was you can't really play this like a piano. It's its own instruments. I was one of the first guys, along with Joe Zawinul, who figured out what does this thing offer. What will it allow me to do on it? I didn't try to control it. I just figured out what it was capable of doing. And once I began to recognize that, some wonderful things began to come out.
Is that anything to do with that very sparse style that you developed? You know, I'm thinking about things like Spellbound and Ashes to Ashes and so on. Just using, obviously, just inversions, which are so tiny. And it has a particular clean sound. Is that anything to do with the sound?
Well, I noticed that you could voice things in a whole nother manner that were rich, were powerful, and very, very soulful. And those things were perfect for the Fender Rhodes, but you couldn't do that on the acoustic piano. You had to use more fingers in order to make it rich and full. So, yeah, I was very, very, very pleased with the Fender Rhodes, and it was a tool that taught me another way of thinking of music, almost like orchestrating. It was very closely related to the colors I felt of an orchestra, of the orchestral instruments.
Give us your second tune.
Basie. Count Basie. I had another old brother who was the second son. I was the fourth son. My oldest brother was born in 24. I had another brother born in 26. One brother was born in 38. In 37, I was born in 39. The brother was born in 26, loved blues and Count Basie, and he had a collection of wonderful records. I also had the music books, the scores of Mary Lou Williams, and that was my oldest brother. He had George Shearing, Ellington Basie. And I used to sit as a kid when I was first beginning to read. I began to read 1 o'clock Jump by Count Basie. That was the most fascinating thing. I said, "Oh man, whew, this is so much fun! Damn, I got to do this. This is a lot of fun." And then I finally heard the record. And even today, when you hear 1 o'clock Jump, you hear that entire band, and the most exciting thing about it is that you can hear and feel everybody feeling the same thing at the same time. Those guys play together nightly, you know, weekly, monthly, annually. They were so, so, so tight, you know. And that particular record opened up the... Well, that is the recording that Count Basie made that John Hammond put out on Columbia Records, I believe, in the mid-1930s. Do you know that Count Basie never ever got a royalty off that record? But it was one of the most fascinating, newest sounds of recording, because what Count Basie did was he set the standard of what a groove is.
1 o'clock jump by Count Basie for my special guest in the studio here with me, Joe Sample. So let's talk a bit about the Crusaders. Obviously, a wonderful career with them. You broke up in 87. Is that about right? And yet you also released a later album called Healing the Wounds. Does that imply that it was a bit of a painful breakup?
No, well, you know, all breakups are painful. You know, we were the best of friends. I began to realize earlier that Wayne Henderson had his own plans about what he wanted to do with his life. He wanted to become a producer, and that's what he was pushing for. I'm a player. I want to play. I want to write, and I want to play. Styx really wants to be a manager, a businessman. So all of these things, and I was saying, well, guys, that's all fine. You know, you can, all of you guys, whatever you want to do, there's nothing wrong with it. But why do we have to stop playing? Because when we got together and we played, it was very, very unique. Why did these musicians come out of that high school in Houston, Texas, and when we would play, everybody would notice? Now, there were other musicians at that high school that I would play with. Nothing happened to them. But whenever the Crusaders played, it was always something special. That was the horn sound, a very unique sound between Wayne Henderson and Wilton Felder. It was just totally unique. Yet in that rhythm section, there was Styx Hooper and I. We always had a problem with a bass player. Eventually, Wilton learned how to play bass because he was showing bass players what they should play when you are playing with the Crusaders. I knew eventually if there was anything was going to make it difficult for the band to continue to go on, was to always struggle with the absence of a bass player who, in other words, Wilton couldn't be in two places at the same time. And guys would get angry and say, oh, well, I don't want to imitate Wilton Felder. Well, I'm not asking you to imitate Wilton Felder. I'm asking you to play my song. And if you play my song the way it should be played, you will sound like Wilton Felder.
And you know, your playing ambitions continued, obviously, didn't they? Because, I mean, you've also played with some fantastic people. I mean, from Eric Clapton and, well, most shades of that. That must have given you fantastic buzz, didn't it, to play with that different kind of thing outside the Crusaders?
Well, in the 1960s, when we performed as the Jazz Crusaders, I always enjoyed going out and doing work with the other local musicians in Los Angeles, and sometimes guys would come in town, and the club owner John McClain, John T. McClain, he owned the It Club. This man kept me working. At one point, he was married to the female pianist Donegan. Was Dorothy Donegan. So he was in love with piano players. And he kept me working. And then he would hire guys in his club. Like he would get in, Hartman, Johnny Hartman. He would bring in Joe Williams. I was on call. You know, singers would come in. And I would be the call. I would be the piano player who would do the shows with the traveling singer, which was Johnny Hartman. It just went on and on. I was supposed to do some gigs once at the It Club with Aretha Franklin, and they told me, now Joe, you got to get ready for this. I said, I know. So I went and bought two Aretha Franklin albums and listen, And when I first met with her, I played her music just like she played it. I imitated her touch. But it was, I loved doing that because I never would have played like that. But learning what she felt, that was always an exciting thing to me, to feel really what someone else is feeling. Sometimes that can be, you know, intimidating. Sometimes you are afraid of trying to do that. But to me, I knew, man, I'm learning a bunch of shit here. This is good. It's like eating Chinese food, Russian food. I don't want to miss nothing.
Give us your third tune.
Well, Duke Ellington. We always knew that jazz was composed of, or the ingredients of jazz were very, very rich. There was a European influence, there was a gospel influence, there was a blues influence. I knew that I love Miles Davis, but I would probably never work with Miles Davis, although I did record one song on the Amanda album. Miles Davis was from the same region that I was. We were basically known, just like Count Basie, we were territorial musicians. All the music was a blend, a gumbo of spiritual, gospel, blues, jazz. When you hear Miles Davis hold a note and play it, I hear moaning. Moaning was the religious music of the West African, and they used the pentatonic scale. When the British in the colonies first heard the Africans and their pentatonic scales, they thought that something was wrong with the brain of the African because they didn't use the diatonic scale. Boom, 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 boom. The Africans did not like that scale. That scale was boom, 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 boom. It was a blues scale.
Yeah.
And then the wildest thing is now, every singer in the world is using the pentatonic scale. Isn't that the wildest thing? So anyway, what was I leading at? Duke Ellington had all of that. When you listen to all of the great bands, all of the great black bands, and even some of the great white bands, a lot of times you will hear sophistication, sophistication, sophistication deep into the music, you know, with European concept of harmonies on that. But that lead voice is moaning. The Duke Ellington band had Johnny Hodges. Johnny Hodges was the Miles Davis of the alto saxophone. He moaned. You know, it was blues, that influence of the West African spirituality. But Duke Ellington really, really took the European sense of sophistication and made this perfect, perfect blend of the Ellingtonian style. He was awesome. And then Tommy La Puma, when I did the Spellbound album, he asked me to what I do this one piece, a Duke Ellington piece that was called what is the thing? The time you turn it over, and not a time clock, hour hand.
No, it's a sand, an egg timer, something like that.
Hourglass.
Exactly. So Duke Ellington wrote this piece called Hourglass, and he said, I want you to play this. And he said, because this sounds like one of your compositions. And I said, yeah, I know there's a lot of pieces that the Duke Ellington wrote that it seems like I wrote it too. So I was so, and I didn't know this. I began to discover that when I would sit and write things, they would come out a lot of times, you know, with a Duke Ellington mode.
That was Duke Ellington and the A-Train for my special guest this evening, Joe Sample. Right, let's talk about Randy Crawford and let's talk about street life. And that was something which I think obviously brought you to a much, much wider audience and her as well. And some of the albums since then, Feeling Good and in particular No Regrets, it seems to me that her voice changed quite a lot over those years. Tell us about street life. How did you two meet?
I found out because Randy Crawford told me that she would listen to the Crusaders while she was still living in Cincinnati. She was born in Georgia, Macon, Georgia. She was raised in Cincinnati, and the Crusaders occasionally would do a jazz club in Cincinnati. I didn't meet Randy there. I met her in Los Angeles, where I got a call from Stuart Levine and Warner Brothers. The year was 76, and they asked, would I play piano on Randy's first recording on the Warner Brothers label. I then played piano on Randy's third recording of the Warner Brothers label. After that second meeting with her, which was over a two-year period, I began to think this is the only singer that I know who could sing the songs I would like to write. I don't like top 40. I don't like baby, baby, baby songs. I have no interest in lyrics. I left my heart in San Francisco. I mean, I love rich, rich, powerful, powerful tunes. I had no desire to write R&B songs. I wanted to write my music, and I always knew that perhaps one day I will do that because I love the vocals that Jimmy Rushin did with Basie, what Joe Williams did, Ellington and his vocal music, and I'll always love that. I love Sinatra, Nat Cole singing. All of those things were appealing to me. But in this world that I lived in, I was considered a freak because I played jazz. So no one would call me on a recording session in L.A. because they'd say, oh, man, that dude will come in here, man, and he's going to mess the whole recording session up. You know, he's one of them jazz heads. No, you can't call him in here. Then I was making demos for songwriters. No one liked the songs of the songwriters, and these songwriters would come to my house. I was making money on the side. I would play their song. I had a two track recorder. Hmm. Their vocal went on one track. I put piano on the other track. They would take it all around town trying to set it to record companies. No one would buy these guys' songs or their voice, but they'd always wonder, who in the hell is that playing the piano? So then they stopped thinking of me as being that old jazz piano player, right? It's just, they had no idea. Then once I started doing that, then the jazz critics started calling me a boogie-woogie man, and I'm not a jazz musician. So I went from not being able to be soulful. You know what? It's crazy. People would always put you in a category.
But it was a good musical marriage, obviously, with Randy Crawford, wasn't it?
Randy heard the Crusaders in Cincinnati. Hmm. And she would always say, that's the kind of band I need. That band that they are bluesy, they are soulful, they are sensitive, they are not loud, and they are sophisticated. Randy describes the Crusaders for me. Soulful, blues, sensitive, sophisticated. That's Duke Ellington, too. That's Count Basie, too. Mm. So Randy, and now after those two recordings that I worked with her in 76 and in 78, after that second one, I went to the Crusaders and I said, you know what? I think we should feature Randy Crawford on our next recording, because I think this is the first time that I've heard a singer that I think is really a Crusader also. She feels exactly what we feel. I think this is the only singer that I know who could sing the songs I'm going to write. And you know what? Most singers have a hard time singing Street Life. They have a hard time singing that song. Randy just grooves through it.
She did, and her voice grew as well, didn't it, through all the... I mean, I suppose it always does, but did you notice that right from the beginning? Now she's very different, not a very different voice, but it's matured a lot, hasn't it? She's very, very tuneful.
Well, when we did a Crusaders tour in Europe, must have been... 2000, I don't know, the 3, 4, 5, whatever, and we were actually here at Ascot Park. It was a very beautiful sunny day, and we were outside. We had sound check. We were waiting for the audience to come in, so we went outside and we were under this beautiful tree, and we were talking, and every now and then something we said would trigger Randy's mind, and she would start singing this song, this song, this song, and then she started swirling around like she was a Broadway singer. And I'm saying to myself, wow, this woman, she's a walking encyclopedia of melody and lyrics. You know, I don't remember anything. That's why I never play the same thing twice. So, but Randy remembers everything. So now we get back to the U.S., and we were doing a few dates in California. Randy gives me her recent release, which is a recording that she had done in Europe. I listened to it, again, waiting after the soundcheck to the show. I sat on a balcony at this mansion and listened, and I came to the conclusion that European record label had hired four producers to put together a hit. And I just said, this is just so stupid. This woman is like 54 years old now or something, whatever. I mean, why are they trying to get a hit on Randy Crawford? Why don't they just pick some good songs and just let her sing? I called up my manager, Pat, and I said, you know what? Randy Crawford is an American treasure. I may be the only person who knows that. So we need to go in the studio with her. We're just a trio. I don't want the percussion. I don't want a guitar player. I don't want to, when we do those basic tracks, I don't want anybody in there. I don't want anybody in influencing. I just want Randy to sing. And then my manager, Pat, said, do you mind if I ask Tommy LaPuma to get in on this? I said, Pat, it's going to take two of us to handle Randy. Yes. Bring in Tommy. So, and I had vowed I wasn't going to ever work with Randy Crawford again. Tommy LaPuma vowed, oh, I ever work with that woman again, she will run you nuts. So, I love you, Randy, but you do run me nuts. We went into the studio with her, and Randy remembered that when I was working with her on Street Life, and one day I'm flying away and some other things of hers, I used to always tell a man, please don't shout and yell and scream. I can't stand that, Randy. I can't stand it. Randy, don't come in here pulling a Patti LaBelle on me. You know how angry I'm going to get. So when we went to work on the recent projects, she said to me, Joe, I don't scream anymore, okay? So she changed.
So she's, in your estimation, becoming an American treasure. You are an American treasure yourself, really, aren't you? I mean, it's no secret. You're 73 years old, aren't you? Well, Paul McCartney's 70, isn't he? So if you're in good company. but I mean, what future plans do you have? Do you ever tire of touring?
I never tire of performing. There was a man in Tokyo at the Tokyo Blue Note. I'm not sure who the guy was, but he knew Oscar Peterson well, and the guy came to me one day and said, "Man, Oscar Peterson gave you a compliment." And I said, "Yeah, he did. What did he say?" He said, "Joe Sample is a player." I knew right away what he meant. I have to get out and perform. I have to play. I couldn't be in a recording studio messing around with knobs and buttons and producing records. You know, David Foster loves that. George Duke loves that. I just go nuts. I got to get out of there. I got to get out and have that freedom of performing, because that to me is where music, the live album, it was all spontaneous things that happened at that particular moment. And if the song is 4 minutes long, 5 minutes long, that's exactly what we played in that time. There was no punching in things. Okay, you come back Tuesday and you come back Thursday. This was live. That's the thing that gets me most excited about music. Yeah, I do like some studio things and when other people do it. I don't like it if I'm doing it.
Joe Sample, The Player. That's been an absolute pleasure. A lovely talk. What's your final tune?
Well, one of my most favorite saxophone players has always been Paul Desmond. And I know that horn players have the habit of falling in love with another horn player. It has been Charlie Parker. It has been John Coltrane. And there have been, and then there was David Sanborn. And then there was Kenny G. And when you start hearing 10,000 other younger saxophone players imitating one voice, I really get bored. And I would go scream at them, "Hey, fellas, why don't y'all do me a favor? Why don't somebody go and start imitating Paul Desmond?"